Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello and welcome to Start Your Week from the Bunker. It's Monday the 4th of March and I'm Alex Andreu. With me this morning, chewing over the weekend's political oleander leaves and casting an eye on the week ahead, is our very own Oracle, Ros Taylor. Good morning, Ros.
Morning, Alex.
Pithier or pithiest. Ros, the week will be dominated by Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak's budget, we know that. Possibly even their election budget, unless they go really long. Casting political considerations aside, what ought a chancellor to be doing right now? What do you think should be at the top of his list?
The first thing to say is that he's in a really terrible place. Taxes are at their highest level for 70 years, and public services, as we know, are also in a terrible state. So where does that leave you? So it leaves you with that dilemma of trying to boost growth while not stoking inflation, which is by no means quite under control yet. So we have some advice from the Institute of Fiscal Studies, and that's fairly negative, but it's fairly good advice, I think, not to cut taxes at this point. If you are going to cut taxes, then make it something like stamp duty. There's also some particular pressures that he really ought to acknowledge, I think. Councils especially, we keep hearing that councils are in more and more financial trouble, that they're having to raise council tax rates by as much as they possibly can, and still that's not enough. You know, my local library will be closing several days a week shortly, and that's almost the least of it, really. And particularly for kids with special educational needs, where there's terrible pressure on councils because that's a statutory duty. That's something that they have to do in law, so they can't cut it. And rightly so, it means that other services that aren't statutory duties have to be cut. You could also make the case that it's a time to rebalance the tax load a bit from the young to the old. And you could do that by looking at things like perhaps student loan relief. You could make pensioners pay national insurance, which they don't currently do. You could try and remove the massive taxation of middle earners with kids, which is a real disincentive to earning more for quite a few people. And if you were being optimistic, you could say the Chancellor could stop freezing fuel duty, which he'll almost certainly do this week because he just keeps on freezing it for political reasons. But that is unlikely to happen because...
it strikes me that anything you have mentioned is unlikely to happen. All of it seems very, very sensible. So, I mean, because it is an election year, he's trying to balance loads of political demands, I guess, from both his backbench and his front bench. Laura Kunzberg on Sunday mentioned to him, and he agreed, that he's inherited a terrible situation from whom remains a mystery. But what do you think will be the most pressing demands on him from number 10 and from the backbenches?
Naturally, backbenchers want him to cut taxes. And they would probably like him to cut things like inheritance tax, but that seems to be pretty much off the table now after having been flirted with for a year or so. It looks as though what he will do is cut national insurance, which seems to be slightly more likely, judging by the reporting this morning, or cut income tax by just a penny or two, not a massive amount, because he can't do very much. And he said yesterday to Kunzberg, "I will only cut taxes in a responsible way," which is basically code for downplay your expectations. It was thought that debt repayments would be falling faster than they are. That would have given him more headroom, but the Bank of England hasn't cut rates yet, and so the debt repayment estimates are up again, which is obviously bad news for him. We're in a recession, so there's likely to be no tax take rise from businesses, and in fact, there's every possibility that consumer confidence is falling, and what that means effectively is a fall in your VAT take as well. So there's going to be probably, you know, a little bit of a cut to that. And how is he going to pay for that? Well, there's a whole load of little issues. The Tory sources were briefing yesterday that it would be like Tesco, where every little helps, you know. So there might be a tax on vapes, but they won't go up by as much as cigarettes, because obviously you don't want to have people going back to fags. He might raise passenger duty on business flights, which wouldn't affect ordinary people very much. He might extend the windfall tax on oil and gas companies. And most worryingly for Labour, he might well scrap non-dom tax status, which would really blow a hole in their financial plans, because that's the big thing that they said they would do that so far the Conservatives have resisted.
Yeah, although I think the story Labour could tell with that might be quite useful in the sense of, you know, why have these people being dragged to the right solution after 2 years of protesting that it's a terrible thing to do, rather than, you know, have the people who had the original idea doing it on time? So what do you think will end up being the overarching narrative of this budget? What story will the government be trying to tell ahead of the election?
Yes, I mean, the comeback to what you've just said is to ask, well, how are Labour going to be different from the Conservatives? In terms of what the overall narrative is, I think prudence. I remember in the early 2000s when Gordon Brown was always banging on about prudence, and it became a running joke that he was very fond of prudence and would probably marry her if he could, but not very funny, but you know, at that time. And I think Jeremy Hunt will want to do the same thing. He has to give his backbenchers just enough to keep them quiet, which means a little bit of a tax cut. But they know, and he certainly knows, that he could really can't do very much more than that, because public services are, you know, on the floor begging as it is. And it is frankly difficult to see in that context how any tax cut is justifiable. Yeah. Although, you know, you will have people arguing, and rightly so, that the frozen tax bans and the combination of that and inflation means that people are paying more. And they are, of course, than they used to. There's also a lot of backlash from pensioners who don't want a national insurance cut because they don't pay it. They want a income tax cut. So we'll see what happens there. But as I said, I think there is a case for rebalancing the tax system a bit in favour of younger people at this point.
Yes, I'm hearing a lot this morning, I think, about this idea of a roadmap to low taxes. And I have a tingly feeling that he might end up announcing sort of staggered tax cut. It feels like they are kind of leading down towards that story. Jam tomorrow, basically.
Yes, nice phrase. Yeah. What that also means, of course, is public services cuts. Because if there are tax cuts, because public services carry on needing more and more money with inflation and just because they're in a terrible state, then that will also be predicated on cuts, real terms cuts to public services. Now, you can't really cut schools that much and NHS because they're ring-fenced. So that means heavier cuts fall on other departments, like, say, justice.
Or defence.
State that is in. Or defence, indeed, yeah, which I think he's trying to kick down the road a bit until we get a clearer sense of what Britain practically needs to do to combat a Russian threat.
Well, I mean, as the OBR chief pointed out a month ago, they have no detailed departmental spending plans past next March. So literally, they just have the government saying, we will spend less and take in more tax, but no explanation as to how that might come about. Now, Sunak made yet another attempt at a big political moment with a televised speech outside Number 10, lectern and all, on the rise of extremism. Why has that attracted such criticism, Roz?
Well, it is a bit difficult to criticise extremism when there is plenty in your own party and you often seem to hesitate to denounce it yourself. That is the main criticism. That said, he has a point. You know, he was speaking just after George Galloway was elected in Rochdale. And there is no doubt that there is an increased terror threat in the country. It's now gone up to critical, which is the highest level since 9/11, due to tensions over Gaza and more people being radicalized. But as you implied, the Conservatives have their own problems with Islamophobia and with, you know, a gradual drift, not even gradual anymore, to the right, where we saw Liz Truss at CPAC last week aligning herself with people on the far right. We see many Tory MPs effectively endorsing Trump. And we also saw Lee Anderson, who of course has now been removed from the Tory party for however long, we don't know, and Liz Truss appearing together at a Tory fundraiser on the Friday. And apparently Lee Anderson got a rapturous reception from members. Two-thirds of party members actually opposed his suspension. So we wait and see whether he will decide to join the Reform Party and whether any other MPs will follow him. And it is worth noting that for all people say Reform is not a genuine threat, it keeps ticking up in the polls. A little percentage point every 2 or 3 months, it goes up. And that is a real, real worry for Rishi Sunak, who I don't think wants to be dragged towards that, but is constantly being hauled in that direction by his backbenchers.
Yes, I think the problem is that, you know, for all his rhetoric, the Tory ad campaigns have been very aggressive. I mean, there was something that went out a couple of months ago that was saying Starmer is a friend of terrorists because he, you know, he was a barrister. So by cab rank rule, he has taken the cases of unsavory people, as every single defense barrister has. I mean, shouldn't a push to bring the temperature down start with one's own words, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, I mean, it should. And of course, the right-wing press is complicit in this pull to the right. We had the suggestion over the weekend that Breonna Jay's killers shouldn't have received legal aid. Well, of course, they didn't receive legal aid. Their lawyers received legal aid because kids appearing in court need somebody to represent them. And that is a basic principle of a democratic society. Yeah. And to suggest otherwise is very worrying. Yeah, he needs to somehow tone down his party. And I don't really understand, to be honest, given the situation that Sunak finds himself in, with likely just a few more months maximum in power, why he doesn't go harder. And I think the only explanation, go harder in cracking down on extremism and party, I mean. And I think the only explanation is that he does fear that if he did, lots of MPs would quit and go to Reform, and the Tory party would effectively be, well, it's already going to be hammered at the next election, but utterly destroyed.
It seems that on a sort of tangentially related subject, Michael Gove's review of the relevant legislation is imminent. And there are reports that the definition of extremism will be widened to include undermining our values and institutions. How much trouble is Liz Truss in, do you think?
Sadly, probably not the kind of extremism that they mean. It's difficult to know exactly how this would be enacted and what it would mean. There is talk that it would mean banning MPs from engaging with disruptive groups or groups that are deemed disruptive by who it is not entirely clear. That might include groups like the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, which is behind some of the biggest recent protests in London. Now, there are many problems with this. You know, MPs are elected to represent their constituents. Much as I, frankly, do not like George Galloway, George Galloway has been elected for a particular reason and on a particular platform. And to say that despite that, he cannot engage with the Palestine Solidarity Campaign is a very difficult thing to do if you are going to respect the views of the people who elected him.
But I mean, that's another thing Sunak tried to do with his speech, Ros. He sort of tried to hang Galloway on Labour. He's being sworn in as an MP today, by the way. I mean, I would point out that the Conservatives did have a candidate in the race, and he came, I think, fourth or fifth. I don't entirely understand why it is Labour's responsibility to defend against that sort of character in that sort of seat and not, you know, other parties who stand up, candidates. I mean, surely there is also a lesson there that people hate the Conservatives so much they would rather vote for George Galloway.
Well, there is a lesson for Labour in that they need to be even more careful about scrutinising their parliamentary candidates for anti-Semitism. And they're absolutely, he does have a point. But as you say, the voters of Rochdale didn't really have a proper choice at this election. Nonetheless, they made a stand and many of them cast a protest vote for George Galloway.
Yeah.
And in that context, it is something that will be heeded. And it is something that I think ultimately, for all I dislike Galloway, as I said, has to be respected.
Do you think the by-election sort of fallout has been slightly overhyped as a turning point, or will it be that influential?
It's not a turning point in British politics by any means, because his party, the Workers' Party, does not have wide appeal. And George Galloway himself is a maverick. There's no way that other people standing for the same party could replicate his success, I don't think. The way in which it might be a turning point, and last thing I hope will happen, but if there is a terrorist attack in the near future, it may well be seen as a sign of the increasing radicalisation of parts of British society. And this is why I understand where Sunak is coming from, because what he was trying to, he was trying to say, for all the hypocrisy involved, that there are pockets of extremism in British society. And of course, there are pockets of extremism in his party, but there are also Islamist pockets of extremism. And we've seen today with MI6 is having a new recruitment drive among ethnic minorities. It's advertising on BBC Radio 1 Extra with various people telling you that it's just as exciting as James Bond, but not as white. And there is no doubt that is not unrelated to the terror threat.
It's also worth pointing out that the way terror threat levels work is that pockets of society get radicalized and then they respond to external stimulus. And it's the presence of that external stimulus in their situation in the Middle East at the moment which is causing the terror threat level to rise. Do you see what I mean?
And that's why it's important to calm Islamophobic tensions and anti-Semitic tensions at the same time. And that's a difficult balancing act. And it's one that so far the government really seems to be failing at.
Rose, is there anything else listeners should be looking out for this week in terms of domestic news?
There's going to be the Rwanda bill going through the Lords. We can get on to the story of a 7-year-old girl over the weekend who died in a canal near Dunkirk on her way to try to cross the channel on an overloaded boat. It's worth saying that there have been about 2,255 people who've already crossed this year. That is roughly the same as last year. That is not stopping the boats. This scheme is not yet, if it is ever going to, which I doubt, deterring migrants. And yet there is talk that if the legislation gets through the Lords fast enough, there could be a flight to Rwanda taking off at the end of March, and even a rumour that that might lead Sunak to decide to call an election, because I think the last moment he can call an election for May is the end of March.
And it's worth saying that the little girl who lost her life on Sunday came days after a woman died and two other people missing. I think that was on Thursday night, Friday morning. And that the little girl lost her life from a boat carrying 18 migrants, 10 of whom were children under 13, which I think goes very strongly against the right-wing narrative of boats full of young male economic migrants. You know, the people we are seeing die in the channel in these situations are women and children.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Roz Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Let us look further afield. Let's start with the US election. This week is a big week. First of all, Super Tuesday. What is Super Tuesday and how is this one likely to turn out?
Super Tuesday is when this year 15 states vote for their presidential candidate. It does look likely that Trump will win all of those. He won the Missouri, Michigan, and Idaho caucuses on Saturday, although Nikki Haley, his Republican rival, did win Washington, D.C. So it's a massive deal. And basically, if you sweep the board on Super Tuesday, then your rivals are done for.
Yeah. There is some quite eye-catching polling around at the moment that shows Nikki Haley would beat Biden more easily than Trump. Which I was quite surprised about. So why is the GOP so stuck on him?
Because the GOP knows that there is a cult around Trump, and people who love Trump and will not countenance anybody else, and certainly not Nikki Haley. Now, we shouldn't just talk about the Haley poll, because there's a New York Times poll over the weekend which made a bit of a splash, and that shows that support for Trump is firming up. So it's 48-42 Trump to Biden at the moment. Even more worryingly, the BBC has a report today by Mariana Spring, who I'm actually going to be talking to. She's the BBC's disinformation reporter, and I'm going to be talking to her for The Bunker shortly, which should be interesting. She's reporting that Trump supporters, not his campaign itself, but Trump supporters, are circulating deepfaked images of him with black people. In other words, giving the impression that he has a lot more support in the black community. Mm. Now, the people behind these deepfakes say, we're not pretending they're real. They're just a story. They're what we like to think about Trump. All the things that people normally say about when they do these deepfakes. But it's an example of how these are beginning to have a real effect in politics and how dangerous they can be. Trump is also focusing very heavily at the moment on migration, which is an issue that's of concern to Democrats and Republicans, and the people trying to cross the border from Mexico into the US. And that is something in which on which Biden has struggled a bit. Trump himself was one of the main figures preventing that from passing. But for Trump supporters, that doesn't seem to matter.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth also saying that, you know, that poll is quite an outlier. The aggregate polling lead at the moment for Trump is 2.2%, 46-44, and at least 10% who are still undecided. Then on Thursday, Biden is due to give the State of the Union address. Do you think the stakes are quite high this year?
Extremely high, for the reasons we've just discussed. He needs to turn it around, particularly with younger people. We know that under 30s especially are turning against Biden, and they are among the people who are saying that he is too old to be president. Yeah. So he has got to turn around the narrative on migration. He somehow got to convince people that the economy, as it is on the up and steady as she goes, and you've got to stick with what you know and not go back to Trump. And of course, we can also talk about we're also going to talk about Israel and Gaza, which is another influence on parts of the US electorate.
Yes. You mentioned the Middle East. There was quite a lot of positive mood music late last week, but negotiations seem to have hit another snag this morning because Israel is refusing to continue negotiations unless Hamas issues a full list of which hostages are still alive. And Hamas is saying that they can't provide that list while the bombing is still going on, because all those hostages are kept by disparate groups in various locations. But is overall a ceasefire getting closer, do you think?
It seems to be, although it's worth saying it's not called a ceasefire. It's called a pause. Mm. 6 weeks, although it could yet turn into a ceasefire, hopefully. But I think the humanitarian situation is now so bad, and God knows it's been bad enough in the past, but now that Israel is coming under more and more pressure to stop bombing, stop attacking. Over the weekend, we saw the US conduct aid drops over Gaza. That's a sign of how difficult it is for aid to reach Gaza. We had that incident a few days ago when many Gazans were killed. Some clearly many had bullet wounds, but the Israeli army denies they were shooting at them. We don't know exactly what happened, but there was chaos when a truck was trying to deliver aid. So the question of how to get aid to Gazans is getting more and more urgent.
Yeah, and Ramadan commences on March the 11th, and I think that applies an extra sort of pressure on the situation. Do you think a stable pause or a lasting ceasefire would largely neutralize the impact of the conflict as an electoral issue, both over here and in the US? We've been talking about it.
It might reduce it, but the question of how to rebuild Gaza and when we can practically start rebuilding Gaza, because there's no point in doing so if there isn't a definitive ceasefire and Israel can just start bombing it again. And that will absolutely continue to be a live issue.
Okay, just to wrap things up, three quick things worth mentioning. First, that strange story about a German defense meeting being recorded and leaked by Russian media. How embarrassing is this?
It's really embarrassing for the Germans. They've said that heads will have to roll, and I can see why. We don't know how this leak of a 38-minute call talking about sending Taurus missiles to Ukraine came into Russian hands. It's also leaked, you know, things the UK is unhappy about. It's an attack on the whole project to try and defeat Russia in Ukraine. And also there's a worry, of course, that Russia might have even more recordings that it intends to leak out just to show how much it can be in control of the narrative and, importantly, ahead of whatever attacks might be being planned.
Second thing, Pakistan's parliament has backed Shehbaz Sharif as PM for his second term. What does that mean, do you think, for jailed rival Imran Khan?
Well, his party got the most votes, but it didn't get a simple majority. So it's decided to sit in opposition and basically make as much fuss and difficulty for the ruling coalition as it possibly can. Imran Khan, of course, is in jail, so there's only a limited amount he can personally do, but he has a lot of supporters, and he did, despite the best efforts of the Pakistani state, managed to get them to turn out in large numbers during the election. His aim will be to disrupt the government as much as possible.
And finally, today France hopes to become the first country in the world to put protection of a woman's reproductive autonomy on a constitutional footing. How significant a moment is it, Roz?
It's pretty significant. It's the first time constitution will be amended since 2008. It has been amended several times since, I think, 1958, when the last one was brought in. It's got 85% public support, so there's no real opposition. Emmanuel Macron was actually hoping that the Rassemblement National, Marine Le Pen's outfit, would oppose it, but in the end, they didn't. And its supporters, of course, say it's important because the right to abortion has been eroded elsewhere, notably in the United States and in places like Hungary and Poland, and that that could happen potentially in France too. Opponents of the reform say it's pointless as the abortion has been legal since 1975, but it's a highly symbolic moment nonetheless.
And that's it from Start Your Week today. Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
If you get value from our work, then you can and should support it for as little as £3 a month on the funding platform Patreon. You'll help us keep making this podcast and get many benefits too. Thanks to you for listening. To start your week, The Bunker will be back with you tomorrow.
Start Your Week was written and presented by Alex Andrea with Roz Taylor. The producer was Liam Tate. Audio production by Robin Leavern, art by Jim Parrott, and music by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.